a new year. I have to learn how to use the iPod all over again. But we're in. All right. Welcome back to all of you that we saw last semester. How many is that? We're in five. Okay. And how many of you have never seen me before? That's what the magician says, isn't it? How many of you have never seen me before? Right? Okay, welcome. I'm Larry Shelton. Talia Glessner is the sales assistant. Associate, they're called now, right? Right, the sales associate, the retail associate. And also the graduate teaching fellow for this course, so you'll get to know Talia quite well. Email her and go to her office hours. She gets really depressed and sort of feels rejected if you don't go see her. So brighten her day. Send her an email every day. Send her jokes and questions about this course, which is what she's really supposed to be fielding. So we will do that. What I just did was put the iPod on, and that allows us, if it's working and charged and all of that, it records the lectures, and after the lecture I go back and magically process it through my iMac and upload it onto the website for this course, which is listed on the syllabus. So if you have to miss a lecture or if you miss something that you think might have been important, most of the time, not every time, but most of the time, there will be a lecture recording on the website that you can access and download. So if you want to review something, or if you can't believe that I said what you thought I said, and you don't want to tackle me or file a complaint with the FCC or somebody, check it on the website and see if I really said it, then file a complaint. Complain to me first and give me a chance to retract whatever it was I said that was objectionable. Okay, we are up there, and then we're going here. Whew. Magic. There. Okay, there are two texts for the course and then a bunch of readings on reserve through Bailey Howe. The first text is the one that we're selling. This is my attempt to describe Bronfenbrenner's system, which is what the course is based on. A framework for looking at human development. This is my attempt, and we will go through that. You will need it. You will need to memorize it. You will need to sleep. You don't have to memorize it, but you will need to know it thoroughly. And we are going to spend the first month learning to use what will be for most of you a new language to talk about development and relationships in context. And then after the first month, when we've all demonstrated that we can do that language, we can talk to each other in that language, then we'll look at families and we'll take a quick romp through the rest of the semester. Family development, looking at the family as a context for individual development. And we'll do that chronologically. We'll start with dating and relationships, and then commitment of whatever sort, then childbearing, parenting, up through adolescence, beyond and beyond. And what we will be doing is trying to understand the family as a place where people develop, using a what we call a developmental or a developmental and ecological framework, which we believe is a very powerful way to understand how families function, and that puts the family within the context of a broader context, and I'm going to elaborate on that in a few minutes. So you will need this. Someone asked about getting it online. This is it. There is no other place to sell it. It literally came from Kinko's yesterday. The bookstore would be happy to sell it if I would let them, but they would charge you $3 or $4 more than I do because they take their profit. And it's not that I'm against profit for them, but when I balance their profit against your $3 or $4, I'd rather you had the $3 or $4. And I won't even suggest that you give it to Talia, who's woefully underpaid. The other text is The Six Stages of Parenthood by Ellen Galinsky. And this is a paperback, which I assume the bookstore has. I know the bookstore has it, and they have a lot of used copies. Some people have discovered that they can get used copies very inexpensively through Amazon, and that's fine with me. Ellen Galinsky is just absolutely thrilled that the book is still in print and that we use it every year. So she's very happy about that. We will read all of it, but we won't read it until March. No, February. I'm sorry, February. No, March. And how many of you read it over the break, as I suggested? Yes, all right. A couple of people did. Do you like it? Yeah, it's interesting. Okay. Now you have nothing but the dull stuff to read the rest of the semester. That's what I didn't tell you. Sorry. We will read all of it, so you probably will need your own copy of it, but just in case, there is a copy, or will be in a couple of days, a copy on reserve at the reserve desk in Bailey House. Okay. For the syllabus. You have it in your hand, so I'm not going to worry about whether or not you can read this particular one. And I don't even know why I'm doing that. But what it says is that I have an office, Talia has an office, sort of. We actually just let her sit in the hallway. We both have phone numbers, we both have email. Email works best for both of us because we can check that from anywhere. So since you're likely to email me at 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm likely to respond to you when I get up at 5. So. Don't be. It's not. Doesn't mean I was up all night. It means I got up after 8 hours of sleep. The additional readings on reserve are listed later on pages 11 and 12. And if you don't know how to work the library's electronic reserve system yet, play around with it. Look at the instructions, and if you have difficulty with it, then Talia and I can help you. Or your roommate can help you maybe too. Requirements. It's helpful if you're here a couple of times a week. It's helpful if you read the readings, and pay attention, not sleep, you know, all those things. And that you think about the reading and the lecture material so that you'll know what it is that you're supposed to understand. But I don't need to tell you how to succeed in college. So. The other reason for being here is that occasionally on a random schedule we will do quick assignments, usually at the end of class without warning, that are worth 2 or 3 points, and the course grade is based on the total number of points you accumulate. And those exercises you can only do if you're here, and they are in part a reward for being here, but they're also a check for me on whether or not anybody's understanding what I think I'm trying to say. So we'll do those occasionally, and there's no makeup for those. If you're gone, you're gone, even if you have a wonderful, legitimate excuse, as does the women's basketball team, which is not here today. Because, are you? No, you're not. Because they're on their way to Albany to stomp Albany, right? Which is what the women's basketball team is doing. If you haven't been reading the paper, they've been beating everybody. This is good. There will be several writing assignments, which are listed later in the syllabus. There is a final exam on Friday, May 4th at 11:45, which happens to be the first day of exams. So we will have class on Wednesday, a review session on Thursday, the exam on Friday, and then you can spend the rest of the weekend and all the rest of your time getting ready for exams and all your other courses. I do want some credit. We originally tried to schedule this course one class period earlier. So instead of being at 2:30, it would have been at 1, whatever that is, 1:15. We couldn't, because we couldn't get this room, and I like this room, and the room they wanted to put us in is a hellhole, and I refused to teach there. So so they gave me the room I like. One class period later. Had we been at the earlier... How many of you have a class just before this one? When's the exam? Be sure to check. The last day of exams in the last time slot. Whatever that is, 3:35 or something. Yeah. So what we did was we switched from the very last possible exam to the second possible exam on the first day. And I was happy that we did that. I hope you are too. Okay. Again, the way we're going to grade this course is you're going to get points for everything you do that we grade, and we're going to add up all those points and make a distribution of them, and then I will close my eyes, consult the spirits, and divide that distribution and give the people who got the most points A's and on down. It's a very simple, straightforward, competitive, and highly subjective but defensible system, and that's the way we do it. What that means for some of you is that when you want to know exactly what your grade is at the midterm, I will say, I don't have a clue, but I can tell you where you are in the distribution at that point, but I can't tell you what your grade is at that point because we don't know, and I can't predict what your grade will be. Talia's office hours are listed at the bottom. And then, starting on page 2, description of what we're going to try to do. I'm not going to go through that right now. I will talk about it a little bit. I want to give you some time to read this and think about it. There is an exam for the first class in March on the first unit, and that's described, and then there's a final exam. So there are two exams, one on the first unit, one on everything at the end. What else? My job is to help you learn. My professional mission in life, this is what I do, this is why I exist, is to help you come to understand development and development within an ecological framework, and to think about families and relationships using a developmental and ecological perspective. It's my belief that what we're going to look at this semester is important, and that it will be helpful to you and it will be useful. So my goal is to help you learn it. And all you have to do is learn it. And that's all there is to the course. I will be trying, in other words, to brainwash you into thinking like I do about development and families. So I just want to put that out there. I am going to try to brainwash you. So at least pretend you're being brainwashed and learn the stuff. And learn the language and try to apply the language And if you do that, I'll think I'm succeeding and you'll get a good grade. And if you don't learn it and can't use it, then I'll think I'm a failure, and that'll depress me, and then I'll go drink or I don't know what I'll do, but wander around Burlington late at night and wish I'd chosen a different career. So learn it. And understand, though, that I'm trying to brainwash you. And the way to get an A in this course is to let me brainwash you. Just learn it. And use it every time you turn around. Say, okay, what would Bronfenbrenner think? Or what would Larry want me to think about this? And how can I express that? And that's what the course is about. Anything I can do that will help you learn it, I will try to do. So I've got suggestions here. There will be suggestions on the website. Anything that you think of that would help you learn the material, learn this perspective, and apply it, let me know and we'll try to do it. Pages 5 and 6 give a day-by-day outline. It's fairly rough, but it tells you what to read for that particular day in advance of class. And so there wasn't an assignment for today, but there is for Monday. And the Shelton reading is the yellow book that you're buying. And the sections are the ones as listed on the first page, I believe. So when it says section 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's what I'm referring to here. There is one other reading snuck in there on February 7th, a reading by Jim Garbarino, and that will be on electronic reserve. The schedule also gives you when particular exercises are due, and each exercise or assignment is described a bit later, starting on page 7. For the first unit, there are only two simple readings. The first is the yellow book, and the second is that 20 pages or so by Garbarino. And there are four written assignments for this unit. And they are described with their due dates on page 7, the first three are. And those are the assignments. So no secrets, here they are, this is what we want you to do. They are application, they're exercises in applying the material in the yellow book. So they should be fairly clear as we go along. And on the next page is assignment 4, which is due at the end of this first unit. And it is a larger exercise in using the material in the yellow book to interpret an experience or a series of events in your own life. So that's where you'll demonstrate to us that you've got this and you understand this material and how it can be used. So if you look carefully, you'll see that each of the first three is worth 5 points each, and the fourth one is worth 25 points. So it's a bigger chunk. I mentioned an exam at the end of the first unit. Page 9 tells you what the expectations are for that unit, for that exam. So this is what you ought to be able to do in that exam. And it's just reviewing what's in the yellow book and how I'm going to expect you to use it. We'll be looking at examples of the kinds of questions that I would ask. We'll be using those as exercises in class, so we'll come back to that. And then some people like to know what to expect when they go to class. So page 10 gives you some questions to think about before class to get yourself in the mood. So if you show up a few minutes early and nothing is happening and you're just sitting there daydreaming and want to get yourself into the right frame of mind, breathe deeply, meditate, relax, and contemplate the question. And then that question hopefully will have some bearing on what I talk about that day. No guarantee, but it'll get you into the mood of being here rather than thinking about the fact that you didn't have lunch today. The second unit readings are listed in alphabetical order on the next two pages. Most of these are the ones that will be on electronic reserve. What I'm trying to say is that there won't be anything on electronic reserve that isn't on this list, but there are some things on this list that won't be on electronic reserve that you will own them, such as Galinsky. On the outline on page 6, the second unit topics are listed and the readings for each day, as they were on the previous page in Unit 2. But this is the order in which it will be helpful for you to read the readings. They're not in alphabetical order, but in order of the topic. And, of course, some of you will do all of the reading for the course in the next 2 weeks, right? Right? You do that, right? 3 weeks, max. Just do it all. Then the rest of the semester is review. You do that for all of your courses, right? I actually knew somebody once who did that. She did all the reading for all of her courses in the first 3 or 4 weeks, every semester, and then just reviewed. And she knew everything that was going on. She was a student at Harvard, and she graduated Phi Beta Kappa. And I was so impressed that I married her. It's very, very interesting. So if any of you want to talk about relationships with people who are really a lot smarter than you are, and how to survive in them, I'll ask her to come in and talk. That's my first wife, not my second wife. Okay, and then comes assignment 5, which is due toward the end of the course, end of the semester. But it's okay to go ahead and read it and be thinking about it between now and then. Page 14 is, again, the potential topics for meditation before class. And the last two pages are self-explanatory. There is a lot of writing in this course, and Talia has to read almost all of it. I will read some of it. And when we read, we like to read things that are well and correctly written. So in addition to telling you what the course is about, I'll tell you what annoys me in writing, and here's the list of things that annoy me. And they annoy me not because they're wrong. They annoy me not because they reflect that you didn't learn what you should have in eighth grade. They don't annoy me because I think you didn't work hard enough at writing well. They annoy me because they trip me when I'm reading. It's like mentally striking your foot against the curb when you run across something that is incorrect. So I'm reading along, I'm having a great time, I'm loving what you wrote, I'm thinking about it, and then I run across something that is wrong, and my mind stumbles, and then I have to pick myself back up, go back to the beginning of the sentence, sometimes to the paragraph, and figure out, where was I? What happened? The flow is interrupted, and those things aren't necessary. So these are the ones I've collected over the years that caused me to stumble. There are lots of things you could do that are wrong that I probably don't know are wrong. So it's not that I'm really a curmudgeon about writing, but by the time you graduate from UVM, you should be able to write well and correctly. And that takes work. It is not a gift. It requires reading good stuff. Good stuff. Stuff that's well written and well edited. So read classic literature. Don't read the free press. Not even the New York Times, because they don't proofread either. And not the internet. And not somebody's blog. Things that are well written. Classics. And imitate them. Okay. Off the soapbox, Larry. But that's why these are here. And I really do offer them as part of a package of saying, okay, you want to please me? Oh, let's check that one out. You can, if you're really serious about learning to write. Right, you all have Word, right? You all have word processors. You all have Word or some good program, and it has spelling and grammar checker, right? Yes. Turn it on so that it is always displaying to you red underline when you misspell a word, green underline or whatever, that's what mine does, green underline when there's some questionable grammar, and then stop and think, okay, if it's got a red underline, why is that? Don't choose whatever option it gives you, because it's only giving you its nearest guess about the correct word. And what will happen is you will use the wrong word correctly spelled, and I will stumble even harder. But if you have spell check, if you have grammar check in your word processing program, use it, turn it on, pay attention to it. It's not perfect, but it'll help. You can, in my case, on mine, I can program mine to check for specific things, and I can change them. I can catch them. Okay, that's the syllabus. Read it at your leisure. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, read it. Questions about any of that? Okay. Let's have a course then. Who's here? Who are you? How many of you are first year students? Second year? Third? Fourth? Fifth? Sixth? Graduate students? Post-baccalaureate? Certificate? Okay. Usually we do have some. What are you in? How many of you are in Human Development and Family Studies? And I should know you all. Not yet, but I will. Early childhood, elementary ed, middle level, secondary, nursing, art education, physical education, social work, undecided, engineering, business, psych, sos, anthro. Remind me. No, I can't. I was just going to. Sometimes I catch myself about to do something objectionable and I don't do it. So I just did. Who else? Family and consumer science education. Music education. It was a brief composition. Right? Composition for bottle. Who did I miss?
Political science.
Political science. Anybody else? Political science.
Economics.
Communication science.
Studio art.
Studio art. Got you all? Okay. How many of you are twins? I'm not with each other, but... Okay, you're a twin. Aramie, you're a twin?
Yeah.
How about that? I didn't know that. Two of you? Two twins? Nobody else? Identical or fraternal?
Fraternal.
Fraternal? Aramie?
Yeah,
fraternal. Okay. Brother, sister?
Sister.
Sister? Sister both? Okay. How many of you have parents? How many of you are adopted? Through the course, this is a warning. The caution. I will ask questions about you and your family through the entire semester because I'm interested in you. I'm very curious about your families. I will use you and your families as examples. I will invite you to contribute examples of material in the text. But when I ask a question, it is your privilege to decide very quickly whether you want to answer it or not. And if it's personal, private, something you'd rather not talk about, that's fine. It's absolutely fine. So if I'm doing a hand-raising thing, which I will do fairly often, and I don't stop to think about the implications of the question, you know, how many of you abuse your partners? No. Don't raise your hand. Unless you're being funny. Don't raise your hand unless you want to, because when you raise your hand, I'm likely to focus in on, well, tell us when and why you abuse your partner. And then we'll go check your partner and find out if you're being truthful or not. You may always pass, even if I am in your face with the microphone, which I may do occasionally, you always have the right to pass. And there's no penalty, no stigma, no negative vibes from me when you do that. So don't let me invade your privacy without your permission. And it's up to you to keep track of that and to be aware of when your privacy is invaded. If a question makes you uncomfortable, you know, you get that little twinge, it's probably invading your privacy. And I have no right, and there's no necessity for you to share information with anybody else. So that's probably true in every course, but it's particularly true in this course, and it's particularly necessary for me because I'm an intrusive, nosy, prying kind of person who enjoys talking about the lurid details of other people's lives. Right? I'm a psychologist. That's the definition of a psychologist, right? You either love rats or people, and when you love people, you're really fascinated by the things that they do. So where was I? Twins, adopted. And we're going to ignore the fact that Tally is sneaking out. Bye. It's not going to... I'm just going to explain that on Wednesdays she will sneak out regularly at about this time because Talia is a graduate student in the counseling program, and the program that she's in, just without consulting me, just obnoxiously scheduled a class that is required for her to start at 3:30, and she has to get there and settle in. So she's going to be leaving us early on Wednesdays, and she'll do that without making a big commotion, and I won't comment on it for the rest of the semester. What that means is that if you have business with Talia, and you think, oh, well, I'll wait till after class on Wednesday, you can't do that because she won't be here. That's the practical implication. So email her, catch her before class. She said she will try to come before class early. Okay. How many of you were born someplace else and grew up speaking a different language than this obnoxious, difficult one, non-phonetically spelled one that we favor in our country? Can I ask where? Where? Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia and Germany and Nigeria. South Korea. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. How many of you are from New Jersey? Another foreign culture. Another foreign culture, but they speak a dialect of English, so it's okay. How many of you are born and raised in Vermont? Okay. New Hampshire? Maine? A couple of maniacs? What else is there nearby? Oh yeah, Massachusetts. Connecticut. Itty bitty one, Rhode Island. New York? Yeah. Midwest? Where?
Chicago?
I never would have guessed. I'm from Illinois. Yeah, I am. Not from Chicago. You all know that Illinois is 500 miles long and that in the north it connects to Wisconsin, and then there's this little piece up by the lake called Chicago, which has nothing to do with the rest of the state. Okay. And then in the south, it borders Kentucky. And in the south, it's rural, very agricultural. It's a completely different culture than Chicago. And they even speak differently, and I'm trying to warm my vocal cords up to give you an example of how I grew up, but I can't do it. I'm going to have to go call my sister and talk to her. It takes about 5 minutes talking to my sister, and I can do Southern Illinois, but for some reason I'm resisting it at the moment. It's a very different part of the world than Chicago. Okay, California? The West Coast. New Mexico. Where? Santa Fe. My children and their children are all in Albuquerque. Were you there New Year's? Santa Fe. Get any snow? Santa Fe had 2 feet of snow. Well, three. Okay. I thought Taos had three. Santa Fe. Oh, I'm sorry. 2 in 1 day. Yeah, that was it. Albuquerque had 1 foot in 1 day. I was there playing the kids in the grand snow? In the grand snow, yes. Grandchildren. I'll show you pictures of the kids. Okay, how many of you are only children? 1, 2, 3. I don't mean how many of you are still children. I mean, how many of you have no siblings? That's the appropriate way. Okay. In my other two classes with more than 50 people, I have no only children. I don't know what the admissions office is doing, but they're discriminating against people who don't have siblings, I guess. How many of you have one sibling? Two? 3, 4, 5, 9. Somewhere between 5 and 9. 10 or more. I have one in my family systems course who has 9 siblings. And we started calculating. She has to do a genogram. And her father's one of 13, and her mother's one of 7 or 8. And you start figuring out how many aunts and uncles you have. How many of you have blended families? Parents who are married to somebody who wasn't your original biological parent? Does that make sense? Yeah. Lots of us. How many of you have parents who are... No. Skip that question. We will talk about that question after I know you a little bit better. At the end of the semester, one of the things that we'll be doing is looking at some examples of using a developmental viewpoint to understand family transitions. And because my own work is deeply in divorce and remarriage, and parenting in divorce and remarriage, I'll be using that as an example, and by that time I'll know you well enough that we'll have some things to talk about, perhaps. The family size question, the number of siblings, focuses us on the family constellation, the structure of the family, the number of people in it, and their sex, and their order, and where you fit in that constellation. And then the blending of parents, bringing in of step-siblings, will be a major topic for us as we look at what happens within families that are constituted in different ways. So we're going to be focusing on the family constellation because that determines what kinds of roles people play in their families, the impact of the family, the challenges that you have growing up, the models that you may have growing up or not have, and all of those differences among us, the variation in the way our families are constructed, have an impact on creating the differences among us as individuals. So part of what we're going to be doing this semester is looking at what happens in the family because of the way it's constituted, and then how that impacts the development of people who are in that family. So this language is going to give you a way of thinking about your family and other people's families, and understanding if there are differences, what differences those might have on development of people growing up in a particular family. Okay. We'll get there. It'll take us a little while. Anything else I should know about you? How many of you love dogs? And the cat people? You notice they're not sitting together. That's very interesting. How many of you have horses? Cars? Bicycles? Okay. What do you want to know about me? I am by training a developmental psychologist, and I've been at UVM for coming up on 35 years. So before you were born, I was teaching here. How many of you have family members, like parents, who had a course with me? Okay, good. How many of you have older siblings who've had a course with me? Maybe. Okay. I keep running into people, and I fairly regularly now get students whose parents I taught. This is a bit scary, but when it happens, I'm always willing to talk about what their parents were like. I have not yet had grandparents. So if any of you have grandparents who had courses with me, don't tell me. I'm not sure I can take it. So I've been a developmental psychologist for those 35 plus another 3 years that I taught before I came here. My particular interests have changed over the years, from child psychology and what we can do to help kids who are emotionally disturbed. That's where I started out. To helping parents, to teaching about parents, to teaching people about families, to teaching people about parenting within families, within the social context. In other words, as I've learned more, my perspective has gotten larger. I teach the lifespan development course that some of you recently have suffered through. I teach a course after this one, the continuation of this course next fall, is the social context of development. My specialty has been in the past, and I suppose still is, adolescent development. The adolescents that you were of interest to me. I teach the Advanced Family Systems course in Human Development and Family Studies, and a seminar on parenting through separation and divorce and remarriage, and a seminar on boys and men, also advanced child development. So those are the courses that I teach and I'm most interested in. When I switch hats, one of my responsibilities is a workshop for parents in family court. So if your parents divorce in Vermont and they have minor children when they divorce, they take a 4-hour workshop that I helped create, and I train the instructors. I supervise the instructors for that. It's taught all over the state. And that's supported by the seminar on parenting through separation and divorce that I teach. So we teach about 2,500 parents a year what they did wrong. What we try to teach them is how not to do anything else wrong now that they're divorcing, because they probably can make things worse if they don't pay attention to what they're doing to their children from now on. And that's the purpose of the course, is at least to sensitize them to the fact that they have choices and they don't have to continue to make life hell for their children. They can choose to do that, but we'd rather they chose it rather than ignorantly blundered on through their separation and divorce, making life miserable for their children. If that sounds like a well-rehearsed soapbox speech, it is. I give that one fairly often. And the other thing that I do is workshops for parents and teachers, particularly on boys and the problems that boys have trying to deal with school and expectations that may not fit well with some of the characteristics of boys. So I will not do that one in here, but it's fun to do. I'm doing it in a school tomorrow. Okay. Let me take a few minutes and talk about the title of the course and what we're going to do from a different perspective. You notice that I put the first page of the syllabus up, but none of the others. That's the way it goes. Here we are. We have a course called The Family Context of Human Development. So, what ought we do in that? And when you can't read what's up there on the board, if you'll remind me, I'll jazz that up a little bit. Looks like we have a new bulb this semester. I'm impressed. So, the family context of human development. That means we probably ought to talk about humans and development and families and context. And we can put those together in a variety of different ways. So we're going to talk about human development and families, and we're going to be talking about human development within families. Last semester, those of you who took five, we looked at individuals, and we didn't talk very much about families or anything else. We just sort of assumed that people develop all by themselves out there in a vacuum, and that's deliberate because we need to understand that and look at the individual characteristics as they change across the lifespan. And if we tried to put the family in that, we would get overwhelmed and we wouldn't get through the semester. So we hold the family piece till second semester and make a different course. So this semester, we're not going to look very hard at what's going on for individual development. Instead, we're going to be looking at families and relationships within families and how those provide a context for the development of each of the individuals who's growing up in a family. And each member of the family is developing. So it's not just the kids, it's the parents and grandparents as well. And we'll be trying to put each person into their place in the context of a family as we talk about them. The context is the environment, and we will be taking a systematic or systemic approach to talking about the environment. We're going to be looking at the components of the family as an environment. And Bronfenbrenner's system, his scheme, is designed to include the family as one component of the entire ecosystem that any particular person is in. So as we're going to be describing it, using this language that we're going to learn this month, in the coming month, we're going to be thinking about everything in the environment of a particular person. You can think about yourself, I'll think about myself, you can pick somebody else to think about, but we'll be trying to describe the human environment that any particular person is in. And the wonderful thing about this scheme that we're about to learn is that it applies to everybody anywhere, generally, and it's powerful enough and general enough to let us describe the important features of anybody's ecosystem, of anybody's environment. So, and you'll read that again in the yellow book. Now, we could also, with this title, talk about the family as a context for development, which we will. That will be our focus. We will also think about the family in its context. And that means that we will look at the family as occupying a household or creating a household in a particular space, but that family or that household also exists in a larger system, and we're going to look at how we analyze that system. What are the important features of the neighborhood, the community, work environments, society generally, and culture, so that we can think about the fact that families differ across the world. Families differ within a particular community. But the community that you are in, or the culture that you are in, impacts the family's raising of children or supporting of development. And in the system that we're going to be focusing on, every level of the ecosystem, every aspect of the ecosystem has potentially the role of influencing the ability of families to produce human beings, which is what families are about. Families produce human beings, ideally. Some of them don't. Some of them don't do it very well. But as systems for creating human beings, their ability to do that is affected by where they are, when they are, and the features of the culture and the society, the community, the neighborhood around them, including their income, including the religious community that they might be part of, the ethnicity characteristics of the culture, whether it's multicultural or not, and the history of the particular community. So we're going to be looking at all of those to some extent. We're going to be looking at human development. We're going to be assuming human development across the lifespan, and we're going to be making it more complex. So I assume everybody has a basic understanding of human development. I'm not going to assume very much. Unless you were in five and I recognize you, then I know you know. But I'm assuming that when I use the word infant, you know sort of what I'm talking about. Or when I talk about prenatal stage, the prenatal stage of development, you have some sense of where babies come from and where they spend the first 9 months. And you sort of know about birth. And when I say toddler, you have some sense that that's a little more sophisticated than infant, but not quite as sophisticated as elementary school or kindergartner. So you might think about whether you can list all of the different kinds of people across the lifespan in your family and other families and have some sense that an adolescent is somehow different from a child, but not quite the same as an adult yet. Okay. So I'm going to assume at least that much, but I'm not going to assume a lot beyond that. If you need to understand... In order to understand any particular reading, if you need more information about a particular stage or about cognitive development, for example, I can refer you, or Italia can refer you to other sources that might be useful. But I'm not going to talk about those. I'm just going to assume them. So what happens when we start trying to produce a child or a human being is that we kick off a lifespan. This should be familiar to those of you in five. To let the rest of you in on it, Larry doesn't think without a line on the board. That's, you got to have a people. And a people starts here at conception. I'm not going to talk about the politics of that or the definition, but conception is when I start, and then we go to recycling. And what we did in 5 was look at the sorts of changes that happen from conception to recycling. And we broke that down to look at biological development, cognitive development, and psychosocial development. You know, the body, the mind, and the relationships with other people and, you know, psychosocial. So that's what we did in 5. We just covered that. But what we're going to do in this course instead is look at the fact that when we conceive that child, it takes 2, usually. Not always, but usually. It takes 2 at some level, usually. And so what we do is take, and I'm going to call them mother and father. These are biological terms because the sperm and the ovum have to come from someplace. And they have histories in their families. And then something happens here. You can talk about that in HDFS 65. We're not going to talk about it. Something happens. And we conceive a new human being. So the new human being is conceived into a group which may have a long history, 2-person group. It may have a long history and it may continue forever until everybody's dead. It may not. It might have been a one-night stand. They have no history together. There they are. They did whatever it is people do to create zygotes, and there they were, they did it, and there may not be a history. That is part of the family history for this particular person. What went on before? So in 5, when I said we're not going to talk about where people came from, now we are. We're going to talk about where you came from. And to help you think about that, you might want to, if you possibly can, at least do the thought experiment of asking one or both of your parents, or all 6 of them, or how many ever you have, about the conditions of your conception. My wife is an early childhood educator, and one of her traditions when she teaches is to celebrate birthdays. And birthday—that's one of the reasons we're happy together, because we both make a big deal out of birthdays. And she celebrates her kids' birthdays, her parents, siblings, all that. I celebrate Eric Erickson's birthday and Sigmund Freud and Jean Piaget and Yuri Bronfenbrenner, whom we're going to be reading. That's, you know, we have cakes for those people. In her programs, when children have birthdays, the tradition is that the parents, if they can, come in. And they talk about the child's birth. They talk about where they were living and what happened, and it's really a neat kind of thing, because in our Western culture we celebrate births. Other cultures celebrate conceptions, and they start counting from conception. And it's fascinating to me to add to the discussion of a child's birth, add the discussion of the conception. How many of you know when you were conceived? Okay, there's a way to find out. A, you can ask your parents, see if they remember. B, you can count back sort of 9 months and get close. And in some cultures, it's particularly important to know the conditions of your conception, because that was the point at which the biological parents did whatever it is parents do to become parents and started this new life. And the position of the stars and the planet and the universe and the spirits at that particular time might be important. It's also an important part of understanding your own history, to know what your parents were about when you were conceived. So just think about it and do it. And prepare to celebrate any, if you have children in the future, you might prepare to celebrate their conception by making sure that you always know when and under what circumstances your children are conceived. Which means you have to think about it. You have to plan it. You have to at least be aware that it happened. And I'm not going anywhere with that. I could, but I'm not. At the moment, I'm not going anywhere with that. But think about the conditions of the group of people you joined biologically at conception. And then for most of us, for many of us, what happens then is we create a family. There may have been an older sibling. There may be a younger sibling, or 6 or 10, or however many you have. So at different points, this group of people created a different kind of context and brought a person into it. What we're going to be looking at is how we understand the organization and function of this particular group of people who are producing this human being, as other people may join it. They have a history. If you're adopted, you have substitute parents. If you were in foster care, if a parent has died and been replaced, etc., 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 at any point, you're creating a new system, and that system is influenced by the previous histories of the people who make it up, but it will be unique. It will be unlike anything they have ever been in before, because it will be different. It'll have different people in it. And it will continue. Even if you die, it will continue in some way, because there will be people in that group who continue, unless you're the very, very last of your biological line, which is fairly rare. It happens, but it's fairly rare. That is the human context for any particular person. And we'll be looking at how we understand that context, and then we'll be putting it in its larger context to talk about. What I want to leave you with is that every person in this group that we call a family has a history and an individual development that can be understood to the extent that it's known. Every person in it is relating to every other person in it. So you have a group of, or a system of, relationships among all these people who are of different ages, different sexes, different temperaments, different backgrounds, different origins, different histories. And they're at different developmental stages at any particular time. And they're all changing. And it pretty soon, pretty quickly, gets pretty overwhelming to try to think about that. But the language we're going to learn gives us a start in conceptualizing the complex dynamics as they change over time in a family. And that's where I want to go for the rest of the semester. So, thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to it, and I'll see you on Monday. If you still need the syllabus... Wait. I didn't have Talia here. There is a written assignment. That's not it. There is a written assignment for Monday. Just to get you in the mood. Just pass those back. Very simple, very short, very sweet. Pass that one forward. That's yours. And if you still need the book and have money, I'll take it. If you don't have money, you can come by Living Learning C150 anytime and pick yours up. Thank you.
Hi. I need to buy a book and